this reinvigoration of the Dominguez-Escalante expedition is tied to that, to this DEEP project, which was which is a group pushed out of, by a woman named Carol Hunter out of Newcrest. Okay, she has felt that a lot of our understanding of the Dominguez-Escalante project has kind of faded into the background, and she thinks it's such an important component of our history that we need to kind of reinvigorate it. So that she started this DEEP project, and I'll get into what exactly that is in just a minute. It was formed to revitalize the education efforts about the expedition in time for the 250th anniversary. The members come from all four states that the expedition traveled through. It consists of 60 volunteers, and they're ranchers, archaeologists, historians, biologists, educators, geologists, engineers, librarians, business owners, local historical groups, museums, universities, and state and federal agencies. They're working on the website right now, and by hopefully by the end of the year, it will be up and running. Our target date is to have the draft finished by October 1, and they want members to help review that, but they're going to try to get it open by the end of the year. And it will have a ton of information in it. So if you're one of those Dominguez-Escalante nerds, you can get into it really, really deep. So we were asked to assist. Carol Hunter contacted the museum and asked if the museum would be willing to assist in this evaluation. And so Sheila Mackey stepped forward and said that she would coordinate that. And they put out a request for volunteers to help. And I raised my hand, and Hank LaValle raised his hand, and Joe Oglesby raised his hand, and so we decided we're going to work on this thing. So there we are, motley group. So the government's going to be, there's going to be a pretty good emphasis on it, because in addition to being the 250th anniversary of the Dominguez-Escalante Commission, is also the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So, everybody know what the Dominguez-Escalante project was? Anybody not have an idea what it was? Okay, well, I want to spend a little time going over what it was and some of the basics about it, and then we'll get into the evaluation that our group did. So it was an effort by the Spanish government and the primary religious order in Mexico, the Catholic Franciscans, to locate a land route from their New Mexico colony to the newly established missions in Alta California, specifically Monterrey, and to determine the potential for additional missions in the lands that they were traveling in. So it was led by two Franciscan friars, 36-year-old Francisco Atanasio Dominguez and the 24-year-old Sylvester Velez de Escalante. And for the longest time, people called it the Escalante Expedition, because Escalante was the journalist. He wrote the journal. But it was actually Dominguez who was the leader of the expedition. And Escalante was chosen to be the writer of the journal because he had some talent there. He'd done some other work for the Franciscans, and they thought he was the best suited for doing that. But that's why this project is making sure that people recognize that Dominguez was the actual leader of the expedition. So they originally had 8 companions, and as they traveled, they picked up additional people, and at one time they had 15 individuals as part of the expedition, and they began with 40 horses and mules. Okay, it began in Santa Fe, New Mexico on July 29th, 1776, and returned to Santa Fe on January 2nd, 1777. Traveled through New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Arizona, 1,794 miles. When you read what they did, I mean, they worked hard on this expedition. So So you had Dominguez and Escalante. You had Don Juan Pedro Cisneros, who was the mayor of Zuni Pueblo. Bernardo de Miera y Pacheco, who was a retired captain in the Spanish military and head of the militia there in Santa Fe, and he was a map maker and a resident of Santa Fe. Don Joaquin Lane was a Spanish citizen of Santa Fe. Lorenzo Olivares was a Spanish citizen of El Paso. Andres Munoz was an Indian from Bernalillo, and he was one of their guides and their primary Ute interpreter. He had gone with the Rivera expedition 10 years previously. Everybody heard about the Rivera expedition? Most of you have. You know, they were the first ones to travel up as basically as far as Delta. Then his brother, Lucrecio, was also there, and he was a packer. Juan de Aguilar was a Spanish citizen from Santa Clara, and Simon Lucero, who was a Zuni Indian, and he was the servant of Don Juan Cisneros. And then the people that joined on the expedition were Felipe, who was a Spanish Pueblo Indian from Abiquiu. Juan Domingo was a Genisaro from Abiquiu. And they joined the expedition near Cajon. Everybody know where Cajon is? Between Cortez and Dove Creek. Okay. And Atanasio, who was a Ute Indian who joined the expedition on the Uncapagre Plateau, he was the Indian that guided the expedition through our county. And then Francisco joined the expedition up in Mule Park and led the expedition up into Utah, to Utah Lake. And then Joaquin was another Laguna Ute Indian boy who joined the expedition. All three of them, those Spanish names were names that Dominguez and Escalante gave the Indians. They actually had Indian names, but the Spanish had those Franciscans felt that by giving themselves non-godly names, they were not recognizing their unique humanity. So that was one of their teachings that they taught, they were trying to convey to the Utes. So the expedition came into Colorado from Santa Fe on August 5th near Caracas, which is a region just south of Pagosa Springs, right on the state line. Then they entered Rangeley. They entered Utah near Rangeley on September 12th. So they spent 39 days in Colorado, and six of the 39 days were spent in Delta County, September 28th to September 2nd. The expedition traveled through Arboles, Ignacio, Durango, Hesperus, Mancos, Dolores, Dove Creek, Engar, Naderita, Nucla, Pinyon, Montrose, Olathe, Delta, Austin, Hotchkiss, Paonia, Colburn, DeBeck, and Rangeley. So they traveled through a lot of towns that now exist in western Colorado. So tactically, they did not complete their mission because they got up there into Utah and it got late in the year, and some of their members, for whatever reason, they didn't want to continue to try to travel, so they had a vote, and they voted to return to Santa Fe. But their exploration helped provide information that ultimately led to the development of the Spanish Trail, the trade route from Santa Fe to California, both Los Angeles and Monterey. My interest in it was always his descriptions of the lands that they traveled through. And when I did the research for putting together this book, When the Grass Stood Stirrup High, this is one of the resources we looked at. What did the land look like in the 1700s? And so you can parse information out of that journal about what the landscape actually looked like by reading the journal. So it's a lot of people have recognized it's pretty famous. There's a number of paintings that have been, and etchings that have been made over the years. They made a number of maps. This is one of the maps made by Pacheco. They're a little difficult to read. This book, Pageant in the Wilderness, is one of the first books that was written. It was written in 1950, and They have a copy of another one of Pacheco's maps here. It's all in Spanish, of course, so, but it's not precise like a topographic map, but it's more of a schematic type of map. But it does, you know, for the time, it gave a lot of people a lot of information. That is another version of this map right here. This was one that Pacheco made in 1778. So, this is the route in general. They started off there in Santa Fe, down there on the lower right corner, traveled up to the northwest through western Colorado, and you can see that big hook that they made basically from Montrose up through our country and then back up to Rangeley and on into Utah. So I just want to talk a minute about the Indians that they ran into. The Ute Indians, or the Utes, as the Spanish called them, lived in groups and families and friends called bands. Historical records mention 6 different bands in Colorado and 6 bands in Utah. We have an archaeologist here, so I got to be a little careful what I say. I do my best. Anyway, this is some of the information on what those actual bands are. The Moach, the Capote, the Weminuch, the Tabouach, the Periyanuch, and the Yamparica. The Periyanuch is what the Spanish were calling the Sabuaganas in the journal. And then over there, the Western Ute bands, or the Utah bands, were the Pavant, the Moanant, the Sandpits, the Timpanogots, the Uintah, and the Severits. The Timpanogots are the Lagunas that Escalante refers to in the journal.
Rather than Laguna Pueblo?
No.
Are they two separate?
Well, if it's Pueblo, I think it would be different.
Right.
Yeah, Laguna is like...
Okay.
And those names, they were fluid. You know, the names kind of can change over time. Here, you know, here they call them the Tabouach. That was your race band that... And members of those bands would flow back and forth. And just like they talked about those two Lagunas that were down mixing with the Sabuaganas, you know, that's just the way Indian culture seemed to work. Okay, so this is a photo that was, the route of the Dominguez-Escalante expedition was evaluated by David Miller, who was a professor out of the University of Utah in 1976. He was a history professor from the University of Utah. He contracted with 5 different groups of researchers that looked at different segments. And this photo was one that they took, and it's published in the Miller Report. And so one of our challenges was to re-photograph that site. So anybody recognize where that site is? Well, it was a little baffling to us, too. And as I drove up there to look at it, I turned off on the old Bowie Road.
Oh, yeah.
And I drove like 100 feet, and it's like, whoa, there it is. So that's, anyway, there's the Riti. That's Hubbard Canyon coming down there. And of course, that's the Bowie loadout. And there's actually a train down there. But anyway, so that, I guess that kind of showed some of the challenges we faced when we were looking at the re-evaluating the whole route. So I just touched on that. The portion we'd had was evaluated by Floyd O'Neill and Greg Thompson. O'Neill was another University of Utah professor, and Greg Thompson was a student there, and he's currently an adjunct assistant professor of history at the University of Utah. So they were pretty well qualified individuals. But in hindsight, in working with Carol, they were under a certain time frame to get this evaluation done. And they did do it on the ground, but they did most of it from a vehicle. Okay? And if they couldn't drive there, they didn't go there. Okay? So that came in, some of that became apparent in when we were doing our evaluation. So there is another image of it, showing the other, more of the features. You can see how they came up into Colorado south of the San Juans, then traveled around the San Juans, and then hooked back across and went up and over the Uncompahgre Plateau, dropping down into the Uncompahgre Basin, right about where the Ute Indian Museum is. In fact, they believe that was that the campsite, what we call the Montrose campsite, was right there by the Ute Indian Museum. And that the, that one people feel really solid about. So that became our anchor point in our evaluation. We said, okay, so we're gonna, and I'll show you how we did the evaluation here in a minute. But anyway, so then they, from that Montrose campsite, they traveled north along on the west side of the Uncompahgre River. At one point, they crossed over to the east side, and then they hooked north, went north, and ended up near Austin, right on the Gunnison River. And then they traveled up the Gunnison River, and then the North Fork, and then up around Hubbard Canyon, they went north, and then up into the Muddy Country, and then back, and then at the Buzzard Muddy Divide, they crossed over into the Colburn side. Okay? And that was the end of our evaluation. So, we took Escalante's journal readings, and I'm going to read off this part, and then we segmented it out, because you kind of get lost in the words, at least I do. So we continued our day's march through the meadow, La Cienega de San Francisco, which is just south of Montrose, and after trekking 2.5 leagues to the northeast, crossed the river and dense leafy grove of poplars and other trees which its banks bear hereabouts. We went up a small incline, entered a plain of no pasturage, but a very minute stone, and after going all the way downstream for 3.5 leagues northwest, halted on another meadow of the same river, the Uncompahgre, which we named San Augustine. It is large and has on either side of it abundant pastures and a great deal of black poplar, which is basically the Fremont cottonwood trees that grow around here. So when I read that, I kind of get lost in all the words. So we took that description and we put it in like a checklist format so that we could kind of follow along and make sure that we were meeting each of the different criteria. So they traveled northeast 2.5 leagues. Anybody know what a league is? It's a variable number. But let's see. And they had two different definitions. The Spanish had two different definitions, but it was basically the distance that a horse could travel. A league was the distance a horse could travel in 1 hour on good ground. So that was the explorer version, you know, because they had a lot of exploration going on, and they were trying to leave records of what they did and what they saw. So anyway, so we can convert all that to miles, okay? And that's an approximation in miles, because like I said, it's kind of subjective. So they crossed from the west side over to the east side. They encountered a dense grove of poplars and other trees along the banks, went up a small incline, entered a plain of no pasturage but very small stones. Then they traveled another 3.5 leagues in a northwest direction and halted at a large meadow along the Uncompahgre River with lots of black poplars. So totally they went 15.7 miles from that campsite by the Ute Indian Museum in Montrose. Okay, so we did all these calculations. I got on the county website, their GIS website, and you can use that to do a lot of measurements and help clue you in on where you're going. And then we had to go out there and actually look at it. So basically, north of the town of Olathe, on the North River Road, you come to this intersection. That left-hand fork is Blossom Road, and there, it's a bridge that goes across the Uncompahgre, and then the right-hand side is the continuation of the North River Road. And somewhere in here is where that campsite should be located. It is located. So out there in that grass where that red arrow is, it kind of shows that grassy meadow. Things do change over time, and I'll show a couple of photos as we go along. But we've had a lot of invasive species come in, and probably one of the most distinct one is the Russian olive trees. So all of our river bottoms have now got huge amounts of Russian olives in there. So approximately 2.5 miles north of Olathe. I think, let's see, next, I have two more photos here. There's another shot of it. That's the Uncompahgre Plateau on the skyline on the left, on both photos actually. There's still a large amount of grassy meadows. You got greasewood plants in the foreground here, Fremont cottonwoods in the background. You can see all the Russian olive trees coming in under them. But this is approximately where they were. And it fits, if you look at a map, it fits the landscape. The description fits the landscape. And this is pretty close to what Miller said as well. So we think he was right on that one. This is a map that was put together by the Hayden Survey in 1870. They did the Hayden Survey in Colorado 1873 to 1876. This shows western Colorado, and they have trails marked on these maps. So here Montrose would sit right about here. This is the Indian village at the time, and this trail followed along the Uncompahgre and then cut across the Dobies and hit the Gunnison River about by this bend in the river. Okay, so I think that's the same trail that they took when they went north. So this is their description for that day. We set out northward from La Vega de San Agustin, already leaving El Rio de San Francisco, which is the Uncompahgre, and after half a league of travel, we continued 3 leagues and a half northeast over loose dirt and without stone, and arrived at the already mentioned Rio de San Francisco Xavier, among the people San Xavier, Tomichi by another name. So everybody knows that the headwaters of the Gunnison River is called Tomichi Creek. So that was a Ute name, which is made up of 4 little rivers coming down from the northernmost point of La Sierra de la Grulla, which translates to the Mountains of the Cranes. That's what they were calling the San Juan Mountains, okay? It is as bounteous in water as El Norte, which is the Rio Grande del Norte, or the Great River of the North, which we call the Rio Grande today. That was their baseline for comparison, because it, you know, it flows down from Colorado into New Mexico and Albuquerque, and so they were very familiar with the Rio Grande. It runs west, and at the western point of La Sierra del Venado Alazan, which translates to the Mountain of the Sorrel Deer, or the Elk Mountains, they were talking about the Grand Mesa here. It joins the San Francisco, as we already said. Its banks hereabouts are very sparse of pasturage. By a bend of it where we found some pasture for the mounts and named it Santa Monica. On the 29th, about 10 in the morning, 5 Sabuagana Utahs yelling loudly let themselves be seen on top of some hills on the other side. I'm thinking they're talking about the other side of the river. So putting that in that checklist format, they traveled north a half a league, traveling along the east bank of the Uncompahgre, and that river road follows that route, and then it hits Highway 50. So if you go down there, you can see, you're probably familiar with it. I was surprised when I went down there. I said, oh yeah, I've seen that many times. And it's just north of where the all the solar arrays are now, where the old the old mill was. So that they were on the other side of that rise. Anyway, then they traveled 3.5 leagues north-northeast across the Adobes, which they're describing as loose dirt without stone. The banks are very sparse of vegetation. By a bend of the river, they found some pasture for the horses. And so when we went up there to look at that site. When you come out of Smith Mountain, you know where Smith Mountain is? Right there where the, when Highway 92 comes, makes that big bend and just east of Austin there, makes that big bend and drops down to the river bottom. There's those two big mountains where the Gunnison River comes out. The right-hand one is called Smith Mountain. And a lot of people thought that that's where they were at. But the river banks there are 10 to 12 feet above the river. Okay? So that's probably why at the time there wasn't much pasture along there. As you go farther down river, east of Austin there, the banks drop and then you have sub-irrigated land. And then you have, it's pretty grassy growing right in there. And that's also where that trail came down from the north that I showed you on the Hayden map. So that's why we came up with, well, anyway, I threw these in here as well just in case people wanted to see the topographic maps that we put together. So there we are. Here's the bridge crossing the Gunnison that was reconstructed last year. Okay. And so this is, of course, the roadbed was built up, but this is that lower country that at the time I think was probably sub-irrigated and they had sufficient pasture. And then just right there below, just upriver of the bridge, just above the bridge, this is what the banks look like. Easily forded, easily dropped down to with a hard bottom and they could cross the river. The 1976 work that was done, the DCI interviewed some of the farmers and ranchers that owned those farms just on that bench above the river, and they talked about an Indian trail coming down through that gully right there, and they could remember that being so. We feel pretty confident this is where they were, and this is different than what the Miller expedition. It's a little farther downriver, a little farther west than what the Miller expedition came up with. Okay. You guys ever, if Hank or Joe, if you want to add anything, just don't hesitate. Okay, so they were there for 2 days because they, their guide was telling them they needed to go talk to the big Indian encampment. And they knew that that meant that they had to head east to go meet with that Indian encampment. And they knew that wasn't the way they wanted to go. You know, if you're going to California, you don't go east. You go west. So they sat there. They sent their guide their Indian guide up there to scout out the situation. And while they're waiting, that's when those five Indians came down from the north. So after they all came back and they had a big confab, they decided, yep, we're going to go up there, we're going to meet that Indian group, and we're going to see if we can get a guide that will take us into Utah. So the next day, the next morning, well, actually they talked a long time and they didn't leave till the afternoon. We left Santa Monica, they crossed the river in which the water reached well above the shoulder blades of the horses. They climbed a hill and over broken terrain but tractable and without stone, traveled upstream and east northeast for 2 leagues. Then after going another 2 northeast over country not quite as broken up, but with some sagebrush, a lot of prickly pear cactus, and finely ground back lava, we halted at the edge of a little river which we named Santa Rosa, which is LaRue Creek. It rises in La Sierra del Venado Alazan, on the southern flank of which we now find ourselves, and enters into the San Xavier, the Gunnison River. Here it is a medium-sized meadow of good pasturage and a scenic grove of white poplar and scrub oak. Travel 4 leagues. So that was always a question. Why did they think LaRue Creek flowed into the Gunnison? As we talked about it, how do you make those two mesh? Well, when you travel along Highway 92 and you look off when you're getting towards the Pleasure Park, and if you look to your right downriver, you can't make out where the Gunnison comes in. And when we looked at it, they were somewhere in that area, but I don't think they could tell that the Gunnison actually turned to the south and went up the through the Gunnison Gorge. And so I think that's why that says that, because it's not true. All right, so there's our checklist. They crossed the river, they climbed a hill, they traveled east-northeast over 2 leagues, they traveled northeast another 2 leagues over less country, but with sagebrush, prickly pear cactus, and finely ground black lava. So do you know what they're going over there? Ben?
Well, no, I was going to ask another question.
Rogers Mason. So there, and I mean Rogers Mason, there's the museum has got some old photographs of Rogers Mason, and that's pretty much describes what it was like. Sagebrush, prickly pear cactus, and a lot of the little basalt boulders and stones that were in it.
But then what do you make of them saying the water was up to the horse's shoulders? Because it's August, how is the Gunnison that high?
There was, well, you know, every year is different, right?
Yeah.
And I do know from some of the research I did, there was another expedition that came through the country in 1953, and they tried to cross right at Gunnison, or not Gunnison, where Delta is today, and they tried to cross, it was either late June or early July, they tried to cross the Gunnison. They lost all of their stuff. Mm-hmm. So they had to come back to the south side of the river, send half the expedition back to Taos to resupply, and then turn around and come back. I'll have to look what the name of that, but it was the same time. It was the same year that the Gunnison expedition came through. This was another one that was kind of paralleling them, and because there was a big push to build that railroad through there. So anyway, but a lot of water. I mean, we've got the Paoni Reservoir, and we've got the 3 dams on the Gunnison, you know, that are all affecting water flows. So you got some of that going on, and then every year's a little different. It's hard to tell, was that a big snow year that year? I don't know. There's some things you just, they're going to kind of remain a bit of a mystery.
Hey. Jill pointed out their horses were smaller back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
That's why they're swimming.
Yeah. 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 So there's, this is the Santa Monica campsite, and they traveled across the river. The river's here. And then they paralleled Highway 92 and crossing through the Dobies, and then headed across Rogers Mesa, and you see the red there, that's Highway 92, and we think they traveled more to the northeast at that point, and they ended up dropping into LaRue Creek farther up. And part of that is like when, prior to Highway 92 being built, how do you drop off of Rogers Mesa down into LaRue Creek? I mean, it's fairly steep. The original road was down low, right? But we think they were up higher, and here's a couple photos. So this is the first shot we took, looking to the west, probably along the route that they followed. And then as I was out there working, what do you think of this, Leanne? This is some type of old road. This may have been, I don't know what this was, but this was definitely an old road. And this is right where Shamrock Road comes into Highway 92. So I don't know if, and you know, a lot of the early routes that settlers followed were usually the Indian trails. So anyway, that's out there. And so this is where we think the campsite was. It's right where 3300 Road crosses LaRue Creek, because the slope down into LaRue Creek is manageable there. And I mean, they had a lot of horses and mules. You know, they were pulling pack strings. And so, you know, they wouldn't have wanted to do the whole Snowy River kind of thing unless they had to. So anyway, this is where we think right in through. This is where IX Gulch comes into LaRue Creek. And this is farther up stream from where the sign is. Has everybody seen the LaRue Peak Creek sign right there along Highway? Okay. All right, so then the next day, this was a long day, and this is one that had a lot of confusing stuff. So they set out from Santa Rosa toward the northeast. They went a league and a half over good country and arrived at another medium-sized river, which comes down from the same Sierra like the previous one, and with it enters into San Xavier. And we named it Rio de Santa Maria, which was the North Fork of the Gun. They finally realized that the North Fork was different. In the lees of bends, of which there is all that is needed for the founding and subsistence of two settlements. He was pretty good at identifying town sites. Because if you read his journal, a lot of the places he said that this would make a good town site, there are towns there today. We went northeast 4 leagues and a half upstream over those meadows and through the groves, which it also has, crossing it once. We turned north, crossed the river again, entered a woods of juniper and a great deal of rock, which lasted for about 3 miles. Then we continued by going up La Sierra del Venado Alazan, the Grand Mesa, along the slope of a very deep, narrow valley, breaking through dense clumps of scrub oak, and after going 4 leagues northward also, we stopped at a perennial water source, which we named San Ramon Nonato. So we were talking about it. Why would they cross the North Fork? Why would they go from the north bank to the south bank and then cross it again? That was a challenge to figure out. So we spent some time going up and down the river trying to sort out why they would do that. So again, we set it up in that manner. And there's the maps, which I can come back to. So when you come out of the LaRue Creek, you're up on Barrow Mesa, and you can look eastward, and that's, you know, of course it's all farmed today, but that was the view they had. And then they get over to across Hanson Mesa, and then they drop down into the river bottom right at Jay Creek. Okay? So this is just below where Jay Creek comes down, and just on the south side of Highway 133, and you're looking east, northeast, right through there. And it's a straight shot, you know? Why would they cross the river? So we went back and forth on that. There's another view a little higher up. Well, when we got out there and we looked at it, Garvin Mesa comes right down to the river. I mean, you don't really think about that today because of the road cut that was made for Highway 133. But if you're just looking at the landscape, Garvin Mesa went right down to the river. It's a pretty steep slope. So we believe they crossed the river, went to the south side, traveled along the south side of the river. Here's another view I've gone farther upstream. And this is the view from the south side. So you can see how Garvin comes right down to the river there. And it would have been very difficult to travel. So they crossed the river, they were on the south side, and Lenox Mesa comes from the south, just a little farther upstream. And there's a big shale ridge that comes right down to the river. So that's where we think they had to cross back over to get to where they could continue going up river. And this is approximately the view they had once they got there. So then they turned up Hubbard Canyon. But we've always questioned, did they stay in Hubbard Canyon? And what made me question that is when he described traveling along the slope of a very deep, narrow valley. And they never identified the spring source, the perennial spring source where their campsite was. So we traveled out there and we hiked up Sheep Corral Gulch, which you can see is marked on the map there in Hubbard. And you can see how steep Hubbard Canyon is. And this is, so you come up Sheep Corral, and there's an old road, and it's the primary route going out of the canyon and coming up back up to this oak, this brushy country. And anyway, they, as you go north from there, you travel through this thick infestation of oak brush. Even when there's a road, it's, you know, I worked up there for 20 years, and Vic probably worked even longer. And you know, I mean, that oak brush is always growing. It's always getting thicker and brushier and rough travel. But when you get to, and the mileage fits, this is what's called Grouse Spring. And this big grassy meadow with this perennial spring coming out right there, which would make a really nice campsite, right? There's right below. And anyway, that's Pilot Knob. Maybe many of you know where Pilot Knob is. But Hubbard Canyon is down in that low spot there. So that's what we think happened, is that instead of being in Hubbard Canyon, they climbed out of it, and they were on the west side, traveling through the oaks till they got to this campsite. And that was a long day, that day.
And then, too, we assumed that at that time, Hubbard Canyon, that upper end of it was impassable like it has been in recent years after the trail slid out.
Yeah, you know, one time, Forest Service had a road up Hubbard Canyon, and the Miller expedition, that's what they did. They drove up that road. Well, it slid in the 1980s, and the Forest Service turned it into a trail, and some of the ranchers still use it as a stock trail, but the last time I tried to horseback up it, we couldn't even get through on horses because of recent slides into the canyon. So it's always sliding in there. So, anyway, we think they were on the west side of Hubbard Canyon, and they ended up camping here at this, which is that's a great campsite if you're horse camping. Okay, so they spent the night there, and then the next day, they headed north, and after going 3 leagues through small, narrow valleys of abundant pastures and thick clumps of scrub oak, we came upon 80 Utahs. Blah, blah, blah. We kept going with only the laguna, descended a very steep incline, and came into a very pleasant narrow valley, in which there was a small river, and all along its banks a spreading grove of spruces, very tall and straight, among them certain poplars which seemed to ape the erectness and height of the pines. Through this narrow valley we traveled eastward for a league and reached the encampment, which had numerous people and must have had 30 tents. We stopped a mile down from the edge of the river mentioned, naming it the site San Antonio Martyr. Today, 4 leagues, 199 leagues in all since they left Santa Fe. So, all right, so you know they had 80 horses, but most Indians had, in my estimate, based on the Bureau of Indian Affairs report in 1880, they had about 6 horses for every man, woman, and child. So you had to have a pretty good sized campsite in order to keep those horses. In comparison, the Cheyenne Indians in eastern Colorado had 32 horses for every man, woman, and child. Big difference in forage resources, basically. So, and I don't think, see, Miller, this is another campsite that the Miller, they never got to this campsite. This was all speculation on their part. So we did the same thing, and basically they left Grouse Spring right there, traveled north, and then they hit Hubbard Creek, followed Hubbard Creek till they hit Hubbard Park. And this supposedly is somewhere in here is where they met the Ute warriors on the northeast corner of Hubbard Park, where Electric Mountain Lodge is, somewhere right in there. And then they crossed this saddle, and I knew this was an old trail when I was working, and the sheep guys showed me that trail, and it's a well-established trail, and it drops into Fawn Park. And so we think the Indian camp was in Fawn Park, and their camp was somewhere below that. And this is what it looks like. So this is the view from the south end of Fawn Park, or Hubbard Park, looking north. and you can see that low saddle there, and that's the start of that very steep trail that drops down into Fawn Park, which is this. It looks like, doesn't you, you can't see the steepness, but it's a pretty steep trail. Been there a long time. And this is that red arrow, it's a 1,000-foot drop from where that red arrow is down to this point, which is a pretty good drop. And it's a really big drop if you're on foot and you've only ever done this before on a horse and you had to walk it. I'm not the same guy I was 20 years ago. Anyway, did a lot of walking that day. So that's, and then you can see the spruces, and I think the poplars they talking up, they were talking about, it had to be aspen trees. And anyway, this was another, when I was going through there, I saw a number of these big burnt stumps, these big trees. And part of the Stirrup High stuff shows some of the fires and the changes that have taken place up in that country. And so obviously there was a pretty good fire that went through here at one time. There were several of these burnt stumps through that steep trail section. So there's another view. That's a view of Fawn Park looking to the east. You can see the Ragged's in the background and the Elk Mountains on the far background. And this looks like it could easily support 30 teepees, right? And hold enough horses there. So that's another shot of lower down. So I'm thinking this is where they were. This is where that camp was. And you get down to Cow Creek, which is what Miller thought that their camp was somewhere down in here. And this is what Cow Creek looks like. I mean, it's very in size, and there's not a lot of space for, this is another shot of it. This is right below where Fawn Creek comes down into Cow Creek. That doesn't look like a good campsite to me. So, I think they were in Fawn Park. Okay? All right, we're going to move on to the last site. So they had a big argument with the Utes. The Utes didn't want them to go any farther. They kept trying to scare them off. They said, you're going to run into Comanches. As you go north, you're going to run into the Comanche Indians, and they're going to kill you. And so they kept trying to talk them out of going. And Dominguez was determined to go. So they had a bit of a back and forth, and they finally said, we're going. And they tried to keep the Laguna Utes from serving as guides, but they were able to prevail. So the Indians moved out, and they went, I can't remember what direction they went, but they all left as well. So they, that's what he meant by we took another trail. We traveled less than a league and three quarters northwest and more than a quarter west northwest and halted in a short valley of good pastures near a rivulet of good water, which we named San Atanasio. We traveled 3 leagues over good terrain and through a poplar grove and clumps of scrub oak, but advanced 2 leagues only. Tonight it rained heavily. So, pretty sure, and the Miller expedition came up with this as well. So basically, they traveled along Cow Creek here, and then they turned north and hit Dyke Creek, and traveled up Dyke Creek, crossed the Dyke Ridge and dropped into Mule Park and camped in the southwest corner of Mule Park, which just looks like this. So this is another old trail that comes, there's this low saddle here, there's a long established trail that comes across that saddle. These are called the Chimney Rocks, and this is the Dyke Ridge. And then this is the headwaters of West Muddy Creek. Is where it is. So this is the small rivulet. So this is looking to the west. That's Chalk Mountain. That's on the west side of Mule Park. And one fork of West Muddy's here, and another fork of West Muddy is here. Right, just to the right side of the photo is a small stream, and I'm sure that was their water source. And there you can see it. And that's looking east. Again, you can see those are the Elk Mountains on the skyline, the far skyline. and that's to the north. So this is I might digress here a little bit. This is what's called the Grove of Balm Gilead Trees. Everybody heard of the Balm of Gilead trees in Mule Park? Okay, so theoretically, those were trees that were planted by early pioneers that were traveling to Colborne, crossing the Grand Mesa, and they got concerned that they weren't going to make it in time, so they stopped and planted these trees to save them. Now that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. When I was doing an analysis of this country, and I got to finding other patches of this tree in the park. I thought, and Balm of Gilead trees are supposed to be asexual; they don't reproduce. You have to transplant them in order. But there's little patches of them scattered in different places in the park. So I got to looking a little more closely at it. And there's basically a type of cottonwood called balsam poplar, which is mostly up in Canada, but there are isolated populations of it in Colorado. And there's a number of different species in Colorado that there's a bog birch that also grows nearby here. You can't find it anywhere else in this country, but it's growing there in Mule Park. So I'm pretty sure what they were calling the Balm of Gilead. See, there's the leaves. And this is the description of a Balm of Gilead leaf. It's lanceolate shaped. It's 3 to 4 inches long. It's 1/2 to 1 inch wide. It's dark green above. It's light green below. And it's got serrated leaf margins, which is pretty much what you're looking at here. So anyway, and there's a couple of really big guys in there. This is one of them. And you could finalize this if you took an increment borer and bored this tree and counted the tree rings. And if it's older than 140 years now, I guess, they're not Balm of Gilead trees. So anyway.
Dave, when you're in there, the old trees appear to be planted in rows. Have you looked at that?
I didn't notice that when I was up there.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're...
Well, I would have shown pictures of so-called balm. I mean, they call a lot of trees Balm of Gileads, basically, and it's any tree in the poplar family that produces that resin in the buds, and that they can use it for medical uses, and the balsam poplars do the same thing. You can use them for the same thing, so. Anyway, this is the description about it. Anyway, so I usually throw this in. This is another view of the North Fork taken from the side of Garvin Mesa in 1898. And if you look at it, you can see how braided the river was in 1898. Okay, and you can see Hubbard Canyon. And that little kind of U-shaped grassy area that showed up in that first photo, it was still apparent in 1898 as well. And this was part of that photo wreath thing we did for this book. This photo pair is in there. And you can see how much change is taking place on that river. I mean, there's the loadout for Bowie, but the cottonwoods have really come in big time. And all of the woody species have increased dramatically. The cedars, the junipers that are on the hillside are thicker, and the cottonwoods in particular are much
more. What year is that picture?
This one is 1898. This was 2004. The retake was 2004. And you can see where they built the Fire Mountain Canal right here below us. So we can look at all of this stuff and we can try to do our interpretations, but there's been certain changes on the landscape that probably limit us to a certain extent. But We think that the basic premise of the Dominguez-Escalante expedition traveling easterly up the Gunnison into the North Fork Valley and up the North Fork Canyon to Hubbard Creek and then up the Grand Mesa and over to Platon Valley is correct. They were right. We believe we've identified a more accurate route in some places and the expedition and more accurate locations of some of the campsites. But like I said, you can't be absolutely certain due to all the changes that have occurred over time. So I think, you know, there's a lot of value to studying this stuff and learning from it what we can. Any questions or comments?
Dave, have there been any artifacts found that could be attributed to the expedition?
Not that I'm aware of. Not that anyone's admitted. I mean, would anybody admit it?
There are many rumors, but not any verification.
Leanne was an archaeologist for the Forest Service for many years. So she's probably much more knowledgeable about this than I am. So,
I got a fairly basic question. So they started in Santa Fe and went north, and they were supposed to be going to California. So what is the reason for that?
Because they had, there was another expedition at the time called Father Garces, and he went from Los Angeles west, and he discovered the Grand Canyon. And he sent word back to Santa Fe and said, you don't want to go this way. So they thought by going north. So Monterey is located on the 38th parallel. Okay, we are on the we are between the 38th and 39th parallel right here. So they thought if they went as far north as the 38th parallel, or between 38th and 39th, and then traveled west, that they would avoid the Grand Canyon. And there were some, in addition to the big deserts that are down there as well. Okay? Ben?
If you go up to Hubbard Park now along the Terror Trail, there are a lot of old shepherd carvings in the aspen dating to the 60s. I was wondering if, in reading through this, there's ever mention of the Utes leaving aspen carvings, or are there any instances of people finding the Spanish inscriptions, you know, in the 1800s or something?
There are a couple of places where they did petroglyphs. They etched into the sandstone. Carol was telling me that they've discovered one up by Rangeley that's attributed to Dominguez and Escalante.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a really cool.
And I rode up Hubbard Canyon with Larry Allen years ago, and we're talking about all this stuff. I mean, I didn't really get into this till fairly recent, but, you know, over the years when I was working, you know, we talk about this stuff a lot. And so Larry was telling me, he goes, you know, you thought that they would have carved something, and there's some gray sandstone in Hubbard Canyon there. In fact, there's a really cool waterfall in Hubbard Canyon. I don't know if anybody knows about it, but it's about a 10 or 12 feet tall waterfall. It's pretty cool, but it's hard to see anymore. But Larry was unaware of any kind of carvings up there. And then there was always the description, well, where's the perennial water source that they supposedly camped at? That was never identified in that Hubbard Basin area. And that's another reason I don't think they were down there. So, anything else? Yes, sir.
Would that journal have been public knowledge at the time it came out, or were they... if they're protected information, would other explorers have access to it?
Well, in the Spanish world, it was pretty well known, and it was used. There were multiple copies made. They copies were sent back down to Mexico City, which was the capital of New Spain, and different explorers used it. And I know as time went on, other European explorers kind of use that information to, in their, it remained a lot of unknowns about the West for a long time. When Fremont started traveling through in the 1840s and 1850s, and then even Hayden, and they did study that stuff, okay? So these are the sources, some of the that are available. This was, this is a translation of the journal. This was the first one that was published as part of the 1976 bicentennial. This was published by Brigham Young University, and then they quit printing it, so the University of Utah picked it up. And this is the same book, but in the new format, okay? The University of Utah won't let DEEP use this as part of their work, but the Warner family granted DEEP the permission to use this version. So this is the official version right here. This is a book called Pageant in the Wilderness. It was written by Herbert Bolton, and he also had a translation in 1950. And then there's one before that. This book is called Without Noise of Arms, meaning that they traveled without military escort. I mean, they basically didn't have any arms when they traveled through there. And so this is another book. This is more of a narrative type book. It's interesting, but it's I won't say fictionalized, but it's got a lot more narrative attached, interpretive narrative. This was the brochure that was published in conjunction with the bicentennial, called In Behalf of the Light. And so this was put out by the commission. And then in 2003, Ken Ryer published this book called Wilderness Wanderers, the 1776 Expeditions. This is a nice narrative. If you want to get a quick read on the expedition itself, this is pretty good. But there's a couple of things in here that there are still a number of things that are in debate. Like, did they take livestock? Did they take cattle with them? This guy says they did, and Ken Ryer repeats that. But Joe and Hank, we discussed that, and it's you know, how could you push cattle 15 to 25 miles every day for months at a time, climbing up? So they never provide any support of having cattle with them, but they do. They state it in here. And there's one other thing in here that's kind of in conflict with what other people say. So anyway, I think that's all I have about that.
And are all those available at the Delta County Libraries?
Yes. This is from the Paonia Library. All these are from the Paonia Library.
Cool. And I just want to point out his book, When the Grass Did Stir Up High.
When the Grass Did Stir Up High. Yeah, and that's awesome. In the library. When we had it printed, we donated copies to every library in the county, and I think they still have it.
They do. Yeah.
Okay. And it's we've had multiple reprintings, and this is the latest reprint, and it's up to $45, but it's all based on cost. Nobody makes any money on that thing. So, but there are some really cool photographs in there. I will tell you that. So. And then this is there's a mural in Paonia on 3rd and Grand. See, that used to be the Cave Restaurant, and now it's part of the Mexican restaurant there. But anyway. So it's a pretty big deal here in the county that it's actually so cool that we've got this kind of historic record that we can take a look at. So anyway, so I encourage you when DEEP gets their website up and running, you may want to check it out. So
would this be kind of strange dress to wear? Would these guys actually could walk through brush and rocks and stuff? You suppose they can wear something else?
That's a good one. But there's a lot of unanswered questions. So here's one for you, Bill. Most of you probably know Bill. Bill is a veterinarian. So were their horses shod and mules?
Another problem.
Yeah. If they were shod, how did they carry all that iron with them to shoe the horses? There, no one ever talks about it, but we don't think they were shot.
They couldn't have been.
No, and then they traded, they did, you know, when they got here, when they met the Utes up in Fawn Park, they traded horses, because theirs were pretty worn out. So they had Indian ponies at that point, and we know they weren't shot. So, but they never talk about that. But we're pretty sure they weren't shot. So, I don't know the answer to your question.
A pair of Levi's is pretty handy.
Well, I imagine those robes were wool. I mean, and they were wool robes, so. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I just wondered if the PowerPoint was going to be available anywhere.
Yes.
Like, will it be on the website when that comes out?
We could do that. If you're okay with that, we could.
I'm fine.
Great. Yeah. We can put this one, and then about a month ago, he did another presentation. We'll put both of those PDFs online.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Great. Yeah.
Working for the Forest Service, I dealt with a lot of environmentalists and input. And it's surprising how much misinformation you end up dealing with. And so that's how I got into doing a lot of this research. So it's good to share that information. So that's what I'm trying to do, to share that information. Yes, ma'am.
And then I read a book, I don't remember by who or what the name was, but he said that one of the stories was the reason they turned east, kind of north, around Peonia, is because one of those brothers was really intent on evangelizing the Ute Indians, and so he said, "Oh, there's going to be this great big group there. What a great chance to, you know, spread some."
Well, that was the second part of their mandate, was to find places to build missions, and he did. They did evangelize up there in that Fawn Park camp. But I don't think they went there to get, I mean, he's pretty explicit in the journal. They were looking for a guide that would take them from Colorado over to Utah and west. So they're pretty explicit about that. Okay. So, okay. Joe.
Dave, why don't you touch on the bearded Indians they were looking for?
Oh, yeah, that was the other, there was a story about bearded Indians in Utah, and they thought they were maybe Europeans that were there, but it's a band of Paiutes, and they did discover them over there around Utah Lake. There's some pictures. I didn't download any of them, but there are pictures of Paiute Indians with beards. Most Indians have no beards,
right?
No facial hair.
And that was our last record of anybody seeing those bearded Indians.
I didn't remember that. Thanks, Joe. That's good. Hank, anything you want to add? It was a pleasure to work with these two guys. It was. We all have kind of different backgrounds, but one of the things you find with ranchers is that they really know their country where they run cattle. They know it really well, but they may not know 2 miles away. They're too busy working. So, anyway, we had a chance to see new country.